Hello and welcome to The World in 30 Minutes, the podcast on the policies, events and ideas that will shape the world from the European Council on Foreign Relations. My name is Mark Leonard. I'm Director of ECFR. And this week's podcast is going to be about the US-China technology competition. Here to discuss it with me, I'm very happy to be joined by Dmitry Alperovich. Dmitry is the co-founder and chairman of Silverado Policy Accelerator, a national security think tank based in DC. He serves on the Department of Homeland Security's Security Advisory Council and has previously served as a special advisor to the Department of Defense. He's also the host of the Geopolitics Decanted podcast. And together with Garrett Graff, he's the author of a brand new book called World on the Brink: How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century. In it, he lays out a grand strategy for the United States and its allies to avoid a devastating war with China over Taiwan. So, are we already in a Cold War II scenario? What would the consequences of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan be? What can the US do about it? And what role should Europeans play in all this? Dmitry, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
So what motivated you to write this book?
Actually, the war in Ukraine. You know, I was one of the first geopolitical forecasters to have predicted that conflict all the way back in December of 2021. At the time, got a lot of criticism for overhyping the threat. And of course, you know, 3 months later, President Putin did invade Ukraine. And the causes of that conflict, as I write in the book, are actually exactly the same as what is motivating, I believe, Xi to try to take Taiwan in the next 4 to 8 years. It is very much personality driven, a distorted view of history, as well as some concerns about their own security and the geopolitics of those countries, Ukraine and Taiwan, and how much they matter to Russia and China, respectively.
So can you unpack that a little bit? Because, I mean, obviously, Xi and Putin have developed a close personal relationship, and that relationship's only got stronger since the war in Ukraine started. But there are a lot of quite big differences between the two scenarios. The history, for example. So why don't you go into that?
Yeah. So let's start with it. So first of all, I think that history was one of the major motivating factors for Putin to invade Ukraine. His wrong view of history, right? And he talks about how Ukraine is not a nation. Of course it is. How it's always belonged to Russia, also false. And he believes also that it's the destiny of Russia, the destiny of him personally as sort of the new czar of Russia, to bring Ukraine back into at least Russia's sphere of influence, if not complete occupation. Similarly, Xi has a very distorted view of history of Taiwan. I write in the book that Taiwan has never actually belonged to China comprehensively. There's never been a single period, a single moment in history when whoever fully controlled China also fully controlled Taiwan. There have been numerous attempts to colonize Taiwan. And in fact, indigenous people on Taiwan are not even Han Chinese. They're Pacific Islanders. But those colonization efforts by the Portuguese and the Spanish and the Japanese were largely unsuccessful until actually the Japanese fully invaded the island in the 1890s and were able to take it over and hold it until World War II. And then, of course, after World War II, the Allies give Taiwan, or Formosa as it was called at the time, to China. But at that point, China is already divided. Chiang Kai-shek, who establishes control of Taiwan, increasingly has less and less of control of China itself as he's losing the civil war to Mao and ultimately fully loses it and goes over to Taiwan with 2 million of his nationalists. But there was never a moment in time when Taiwan fully belonged to China. And similar to Putin, she believes that it is both China's destiny and his own personal destiny to bring Taiwan back into Chinese orbit, Chinese ownership, and achieve the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation, as he calls
Chinese
it.
Nation. But Taiwan says that it is China. I mean, it's pretty different. And no one in Ukraine said that they were Russia.
Yeah, that's right.
Ukraine is a sovereign country that was recognized by the United Nations. Taiwan is not a sovereign country. It doesn't have a Nobody, you know, very few people recognize it as a sovereign country. And they say they're China. They believe in a one China policy. It just doesn't really feel very similar to me.
Well, we have to get into the details, right? What does one China policy mean? Because China is trying to distort that view. China actually does not accept one China policy. They talk about one China principle, which is a very different thing. One China principle to them means that Taiwan belongs to China and it's one country. One China policy, as defined originally by Henry Kissinger and Richard Nixon back in the 70s, during their attempts to court Mao and reopen China, was an acknowledgement, and the words are very important here, an acknowledgement that people on both sides of the strait believe that there is one China. It is not an acceptance. It is not a recognition. It is an acknowledgement. It is basically a trick of words to appease Mao at the time, but not necessarily change the status quo, which is that Taiwan is effectively its own nation today. And then everyone else sort of accepted the one China policy, not the one China principle of China. But you're right. So when Chiang Kai-shek comes over to Taiwan and actually brutally occupies it in 1949 and establishes a dictatorship on the island that was very severe and lots of people disappeared during the course of that brutal dictatorship. His view was that there is one China and he represents the one true China, and he calls it the Republic of China, and harbors expectations and desires to one day come back to the mainland and occupy the mainland. However, in the 1980s, there's a democratic movement in Taiwan. The dictatorship ultimately dissolves, and you have a now robust multi-party democracy on Taiwan. And today, the people on Taiwan do not harbor any interest in occupying China, do not have any interest in unification with China. In fact, you look at the modern polls today, the recent polls, less than 7% of the population today desires unification either immediately. In fact, immediately it's less than 1%, and a total of 7% want it at some point in the future. And again, it's not clear what it is that they actually want, because some of them, no doubt, are sort of hardcore KMT nationalist supporters in the mold of Chiang Kai-shek, who think that one day maybe we can take over the mainland, not that China, the PRC, takes over Taiwan. So there is a growing sense of cultural identity in Taiwan that has developed over the last 30 years. They know that their culture is very distinct from Chinese culture, and they trace back their lineage, even though a majority of the population now is Han Chinese. 70% of them have the bloodlines that trace back to the indigenous population. And in fact, Chiang Kai-shek is becoming less and less popular on Taiwan itself. The ruling party, the DPP, has recently ordered his monuments to be taken off the streets. And the development of that culture is something that I think is underappreciated around the world.
True. No, that's definitely true. But why do you think that it's imminent? Like a few years ago, there was a lot of talk about an imminent invasion in 2027 as a kind of date. But the mood, both in Beijing when I was there in the summer, but also in Washington when I was there a few weeks ago, it seems to be much less nervous about an imminent war. I think, you know, nobody can rule out a war at some point in the near future. But
I don't think it's imminent. So I don't think that it's coming this year or next year. I don't think that Xi Jinping has penciled a date certain in the calendar for invasion. But I think it's very clear, and he's very open about this, that he wants to accomplish it in his lifetime. Well, guess what? Yeah. He is now 71. He is going to be 79 in 2032 when his likely fourth term in power ends. So I do think that window, probably from late 2028 to 2032, is going to be incredibly dangerous. And in fact, he says himself that this is not a problem, i.e. Taiwan, that can be left to the future generations. Well, if he's not going to be in power into his 80s, and unlike the United States, they don't have a tradition in China to have many of their leaders serve into their 1980s. And of course, you know, his own mortality no doubt plays a role in his own thinking, as I think it has with Putin. I think the reason that Putin launched the invasion when he did is because he was also looking at his own legacy and how long he would stay in power, and wanting to do this on his own watch. Ego plays a huge role in his decision to invade Ukraine. I think it plays a huge role in Xi's desire to invade Taiwan. So I think the next 4 to 8 years really are the danger zone.
Okay. So do you want to talk a bit about what kind of scenarios you envisage, because there's lots of ideas about how that could take place. Is it a kind, you know, ranging from sort of accidents that happen to more limited scenarios with blockades and other tools which fall short of a kind of full scale invasion? How are you thinking about these things?
So the way I think about it is, if I'm China and I want to take Taiwan, there's only one option, and that option is a full scale invasion, because nothing else really would enable you to take over that island. You know, people talk about gray zone tactics, these incursions into Taiwan's air defense zones, the attempts to coerce Taiwan economically with trade actions, the propaganda and so forth. None of that works, has any precedent historically of working. And in fact, again, if you look at the Taiwanese polling, it has only turned Taiwanese people against China and made them less likely to desire this unification. Blockade also, in my view, does not work and would be a strategic defeat for China for a number of reasons. One, there's no historical precedent in modern history of a blockade ever working against even a city, much less a country. You know, you can look at examples of the siege of Leningrad, 2.5-year siege by the Nazis, over 1 million civilians, Soviet civilians died. The city did not surrender. You could look at a siege of Sarajevo by the Bosnian Serbs in the 90s, 4-year siege that did not accomplish anything. And Taiwan is actually much more self-sufficient than people give it credit for. So people talk about how Taiwan imports a lot of food, and that's true. A lot of it is meat products from the United States, but Taiwan also produces massive quantities of rice. It has a robust fisheries. It produces a lot of vegetables and fruits. So if it had to sustain itself, it absolutely could and would not starve to death. It's true that it imports a lot of energy and is relying on exports. 70% of Taiwan's economy, its GDP, is exports related. So its economy would absolutely be devastated by it. But again, there's no precedent for economic devastation leading to surrender. I mean, all you have to do is look at Ukraine, where the Russians are destroying its energy grid, destroying its economy. Ukraine has no intention of surrendering. You can look at sanctions policy by the United States against Iraq, Iran, North Korea. None of that has ever worked to change even policies of these countries, much less get them to surrender. So a Chinese blockade, A, would not cause, I believe, the Taiwanese people to surrender, and two, would cause massive blowback on China itself and the global economy because of the reliance of the global economy on chips coming from Taiwan, those semiconductors and electronics that are built on Taiwan. So you would have potentially global recession, if not a depression, being caused by this blockade, and enormous both domestic and international pressure on China to end it. And of course, the first thing that the Taiwanese would likely do in a case of a blockade is counter-blockade China. Its missiles can shut down effectively the Chinese ports and probably declare independence and forever change the status quo. So China would not achieve its objectives in getting Taiwan to surrender and would likely forever change the status quo across the Taiwan Strait. So if it wants to take Taiwan, it has to invade and it has to succeed in that invasion, because the stakes for Xi Jinping are incredibly high here. Unlike President Putin, who I think can lose in Ukraine and still spin it as a victory, because of course his goals in Ukraine are so nebulous: denazification, demilitarization. What does that even mean? He can claim that he's achieved that today and pull out. Xi Jinping can't do that, right? It's very clear that the objective is to take Taiwan, and it's a very binary outcome. You either do it or you don't. And if he doesn't, if he fails at that, I think that could be the end of him and potentially the end of the Chinese Communist Party. So they will not do this until they're certain that they can achieve that.
So if you want to stop that from happening, most people think about deterrence and kind of dual deterrence. On the one hand, how do you stop the Taiwanese from declaring independence, which would no doubt act as a trigger for the sort of scenarios you're talking about. But then also, how do you deter Xi Jinping from thinking that this is something which is likely to end well?
So deterrence, of course, is this nebulous thing that you can't measure, right? You're trying at the end of the day impact the decision making of the other party. You don't know, particularly with Xi Jinping and the closeness of the Chinese regime, what would work. And when we've looked at deterrence in other contexts where the stakes are also incredibly high, namely, of course, the nuclear deterrence theories, we basically decide to do everything possible, right? We tend to go for overkill solutions to make sure that we can deter that disastrous outcome of a nuclear strike on us. So, for example, in the United States and in many countries, we invest in triad deterrent systems, right? We have land-based missiles, ICBMs, for retaliatory strikes, submarine-based missiles, and bombers that can drop nuclear weapons as well. One could make the argument that that is complete overkill, that you can just have land-based missiles and silos distributed across the United States. And we have so many of them that surely that many of them would survive a first strike by any adversary, and we don't need to do all this other stuff. But the decision that we've made as a country, and most countries tend to make the same decision, is that the risks here are so high of nuclear war that you want to do it all, no matter how expensive it is and how involved. And I think the same applies in the deterrence of China scenario, that we have to do it all. We have to do military deterrence. We have to do economic deterrence. We won't know ultimately if we're successful, right? The only way we'll know is that China doesn't go for it. But we have to make China understand that A, if it goes, it will be defeated militarily. B, that there'll be enormous economic costs on China itself because of increased leverage we have over them and their economy and the limited leverage that they could have over us, right? So from a strategy perspective, we have to do it all. We have to not decouple from China economically. A, it's not possible. And B, I think is actually counterproductive, because if you decouple, you have no leverage over them, but engage in what I call unidirectional entanglement. Effectively, tie China closer to us economically, where they're more reliant on us, particularly in key technology areas like semiconductors, like AI, like biotech, and so forth. And we're less reliant on them, which means reducing our reliance on critical minerals that are being processed in China, reducing our reliance on energy sources in China, particularly in the areas of green tech, where they're achieving dominance like EVs, electronic vehicles, batteries, wind, solar, and so forth.
So it's the opposite of what the US is doing at the moment. You think that all of the policies of export controls and entities lists and things like that are mistaken?
No, I think they're exactly right. In fact, they're in fulfillment of that goal, because if you think about the export control policies, most of those export control policies are in two areas. They're in the areas of semiconductor manufacturing equipment to prevent China from achieving a breakthrough in manufacturing of chips. That's not to deny China chips. It is to make sure that they keep buying the manufactured chips from the West, from Taiwan, from the US, from Korea and Japan, and they don't manufacture them themselves and achieve that independence. And it's in the area of advanced chips so that they don't build their own AI systems, both for national security and economic purposes, and that they're relying on end products from the United States. So we're not stopping trade. We're not stopping it in most areas, but we're targeting our export controls in specific areas to prevent them from achieving that breakout capability.
So maybe we can zoom out a bit more and think about the US-China competition more broadly. You have argued that we're already in Cold War II. Do you want to explain a bit more how you're thinking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'm surprised that anyone would even make an argument that we're not in a Cold War, because it is so obvious that we are. And even if you just look at a definition of a Cold War, for example, from an Oxford Dictionary, it states that a Cold War is a state of political hostility between countries that is characterized by threats, propaganda, and other measures short of open warfare. I would challenge anyone to look at that definition and say that the current state of US-China relationship does not define a Cold War. Now, why is it the Cold War, or Cold War II, Roman numeral II? As I say in the book, it's not 2.0. This is not a continuation of the first Cold War. It's a very different conflict. But when you look at what happened in the first Cold War, what's happening now, on almost every level, the conflict is identical. Let me go through a few of them. First, you have a global competition for supremacy, just like you had between Soviet Union and United States. China and America are competing in every part of the world on economics grounds, on military grounds, for influence. Both countries are preparing for war. As we speak, the Department of Defense and Indo-PACOM, our combatant command in the Pacific, is literally trying to build up capabilities, training for conflict with China. China's been doing the same thing for 40 years, similar to the Soviet-American competition. We have an arms race. We have a conventional arms race with military buildups, and a nuclear arms race where China is modernizing their nuclear weapons arsenal, going from about 300 nuclear warheads that they have today to over 1,000 by the end of the decade, building up that triad for nuclear deterrence. The United States is modernizing its nuclear arsenal as well. We have a space race. Both countries are trying to once again get to the moon. Sounds very familiar from the 1960s and potentially the next decade to Mars. We have economic warfare, trade wars, sanctions, export controls. We have an ideological struggle. It's not quite communism versus capitalism that we had in the first Cold War, but it's authoritarianism versus democracy. President Biden talks about that almost daily basis. We have a major regional flashpoint. So I argue that Taiwan plays the role that West Berlin played for the first 15 years of the Cold War, where the risk of the Soviets and Americans getting into a conflict, including a nuclear one, was incredibly high over West Berlin, and now it is over Taiwan. You have a scramble for military bases. Once again, the United States is building up military bases in the Pacific. We're going for the first time in 30 years into the Philippines. We're building up capabilities in Japan. China is doing the same thing in Pakistan and Cambodia and Djibouti. We have a spy war. The FBI director, Director Wray, talks about how the level of espionage against America today is at the highest levels, eclipsing anything that we've seen during the first Cold War, and largely coming from China, both in cyberspace and in traditional espionage. So on all those levels, we have the exact ingredients that we had during Cold War I. And the only argument that some of the critics may present for why we're not in a Cold War is this economic interdependence. But as I talk about in the book, that is ignoring history and how much we had links with the Soviet Union during the first Cold War. The Soviet Union, of course, was exporting a lot of energy, particularly in the 60s and 70s to Europe, fossil fuels, and much of its energy sector was running off Western technologies that was sold to them. So in fact, you know, this whole arms race and the competition was financed effectively with Western technologies that enabled them to extract so much oil and gas from their sectors. The Europeans were providing loans to the Soviet Union in the 1980s that the Reagan administration was desperately trying to stop, that really kept that regime afloat. I talk about how in the 20s and 30s, and even in the 40s, post-World War II, there was so much technology transfer going into the Soviet Union from Western industrialists, initially Germans, British, and Americans.
That was pre-Cold War, though. I mean, I think there's no question that there is a Cold War in the sense that you described it. But I think there's some pretty vast differences between that Cold War and the Cold War, which happened after the Second World War. You know, the first is your ideological difference doesn't really, compute in the way that the ideological dispute between the Soviet Union and the West did. You know, there was a kind of totalizing ideology and different ideas of the future, which led...
We have different ideas of the future. In fact, you know, you look at what China is doing right now in Africa. It is building schools for dictators in Africa to spread their idea of authoritarianism there.
Well, you know, every single Western country during the Cold War had communist parties, had people who were trying to develop a political vision that was similar to, that was inspired by the Soviet Union. That's just not the case at the moment.
Well, it's different, but China absolutely supported dictatorial regimes around the world.
It's pretty fundamentally different that you don't have a coherent ideological program which is being developed in China, which has got people all over the world who are trying to emulate it, including in Western countries. One of the reasons why the Cold War was so existential for people in the West was a fear that their own countries could be transformed by domestic political mobilizations within them. That's obviously not the case now.
I would argue that that was true for the first period of the Cold War. I don't think anyone in the 60s, 70s, and 80s feared the communist parties in the Western countries. By that point, sort of the spread of communists had ended.
Well, in France, in Italy, and lots of countries in the West, they were, you know, in Italy, the Communist Party and the left were quite an important part of our politics. Anyway, that's a huge difference. There are other equally big differences. The Soviet Union and the West made up, you know, the vast majority of the global economy, of military spending, and other kinds of things. That's just not the case now. China and the US collectively, you know, make up
barely a majority of the global economy and military spending. There are lots of other powers.
On military spending, the two primary military spenders are the United States and China by a vast amount. The U.S. spends about $900 billion in dollars. China spends about $200 billion and likely much more.
The European Union spends more on military than China does. I mean, you know, your point about interdependence is also completely different from in the Cold War. There's almost no overlap between Western economies and the Soviet Union. There were a very small sectoral trade, as you're describing, on energy and things like that, which made up a tiny percentage of our. Whereas now they're like vast links. There was no human contact. There was very little travel across the Cold War. You know, it's a fundamentally different situation.
Well, I would argue the trend lines are going that direction, where there's no question that industries, particularly American industries, are pulling out of China. The Chinese industries are being kicked out of the U.S. Look at TikTok. So we're certainly in the early stages of the Cold War, but it's going the same way.
Trade has actually grown throughout the whole period of all these discussions.
Foreign direct investment in China dropped by 20% year over year. American companies are diversifying and trying to pull out of China. Apple now produces 25% of its iPhones in India. Many companies I talk about have a timeline over the next couple of years to try to go into Vietnam, go into Mexico for their manufacturing. So that is undisputable.
Okay. Well, I think it's from a level of contact which is greater than the contact between most European countries and the US during the Cold War. So this decoupling seems to be quite a long way. You know, the US-China integration is, you know, unprecedented in history. It's nothing like trade between the UK and Germany pre-World War I. And it's, you know, it has nothing to do with anything during the Cold War.
Well, I would argue that certainly there are differences, right? But, you know, World War I was different from World War II, different combatants, different ideologies, et cetera, but they were both world wars. And similarly, Cold War I is not exactly the same as Cold War II. Obviously, there are some divergences, but there's also huge numbers of similarities, and they're both Cold Wars.
Okay. So can you tell us a bit more about how you think that, you know, if you, in the title of your book, you talk about how America can beat China in the race for the 21st century. What does beating China in the race for the 21st century mean?
Well, it means first and foremost deterring a conflict over Taiwan. I talk about in the book the importance of Taiwan, and it's not just chips. A lot of the reductionist, simplistic thinking that's frankly quite insulting to the Taiwanese is that Taiwan only matters to us because they produce 90% of the world's chips and a majority of the so-called foundational chips that are necessary for everything from weapon systems to cars and microwaves and refrigerators. But Taiwan matters to us for many more reasons, and particularly its critical importance in terms of geography, that Taiwan is really the cork that keeps China bottled up. If China looks out at the world, at the Western Pacific, it sees itself as completely contained by U.S. military bases and U.S. allies from the Korean Peninsula, half of which is, of course, South Korea, with significant U.S. military presence to Japan, to the Philippines on the other side of Taiwan, and then Taiwan itself, where even though you don't have significant U.S. military presence, is seen really as an outpost of U.S. power. So if China wants to achieve its goal of reestablishing itself as the world's greatest power, something that it has had, as a position for much of its history, it's only since the Industrial Revolution that it declined in power relative to first Europe and then the United States. It can't allow itself to be contained that way, where Chinese shipping can be blockaded by the U.S. Navy at a moment's notice because it all has to pass through those first island chains, or its Navy can project power across that region. And taking Taiwan would change that immediately and would allow it to break out and really become the dominant power of that region and push the U.S. out of the Western Pacific. So deterring that invasion is step one. But beyond that, really, how do you win the Cold War? How do you make sure that America remains the dominant power in that conflict? And I think technology is at the root of that competition that is going to, of course, dominate the economic advances of the century. And I think there are four technologies that are going to be critical to that, three of in which we're leading and one in which we're losing. And those four technologies are AI and autonomy. We've seen a lot of course, hope and interest in that since the release of ChatGPT and even before. Biotech and synthetic biology is incredibly exciting. That is going to be driven by AI advances, where it's not just going to revolutionize medicine and treatments, but even more importantly, or just as importantly, I should say, it's going to revolutionize material sciences and being able to create materials like maybe cement in the future in the lab, as opposed to use energy-intensive processes that are also carbon-emitting. Space technology is going to be really important. We're way ahead thanks to companies like SpaceX and Amazon that are putting up constellations of satellites in low Earth orbit, and China's behind. And by the way, there's only so much real estate up there before you start interfering with each other's satellites. So if China doesn't get its act together, we're going to dominate that real estate with projected 50,000 satellites in low Earth orbit before the end of the decade. And the last one where China has incredible advantage is in green tech. And we've talked about this on EVs, on solar, on wind, on batteries. China dominates in large part because of intellectual property theft that it's engaged in over the last 20 years, in large part because of overcapacity and dumping. And it's time for us to get our act together and make sure that we achieve the dominance in that field. And it's not for lack of innovation, but it is a lack of industrial policy and not correcting the unfair trade practices that the Chinese have engaged in, price dumping and the like.
So where does Europe fit into this Cold War world that you're describing?
Well, it's interesting. You have statements from President Macron and other leaders that say that they don't want to choose between the two countries. And in fact, it's not so dissimilar from the first Cold War, where France also did not want to choose and had connections to the Soviet Union. In fact, this was most obvious in their nuclear targeting posture, where President de Gaulle famously declared that he would do all azimuth targeting for the nuclear weapons, not just focused on the Soviet Union, but focusing on Britain and the United States, and it would make no distinction between the different nuclear powers. But the reality is that France and Germany and others are NATO allies, and if the United States goes to war with China over Taiwan, there's no question that all of these countries will choose, and we know exactly how they will choose. They may not fight in the Indo-Pacific, and they have fairly limited capabilities to bring to bear there, but there's no question that they will not be trading with China while the United States is fighting an existential conflict with them. They will choose, and we know how they will choose. And you know, beyond that, I do think that there is an element of a quid pro quo here, where Europe, it's quite obvious, and if you just look at the political realities of last year, is much more involved and interested in Russia's defeat in Ukraine than the United States, just purely based on the fact that we can barely pass an aid package to Ukraine now in the United States. And there is a bargain to be made with Europe that, you know, if you want us to continue assisting Ukraine, and I do think we should, and I do think it's in our interest, but you got to help us with China. You got to help us with export controls. You got to prevent them from gaining an upper hand in some of these critical technologies. It will be good for you because you'll prevent the decimation of your industries, particularly with EVs, the invasion of Chinese cars that is going to be coming this year and next into Europe. It may decimate manufacturing in one of the most important industries that Europe has, the automotive industries. And I think there's possibilities for us to work together to contain China's ambitions, at least in the economic sphere.
Great. Well, there's one thing left to do on this podcast, and that's our bookshelf segment. Obviously, lots of readers will want to read Dimitri's book, World on the Brink, How America Can Beat China in the Race for the 21st Century, which is published on the 16th of May in European bookstores and in the UK. But Dimitri, what's on your bookshelf? What books would you recommend to our readers?
So there's one book that I think is quite complementary to mine by a good friend of mine, Sergei Radchenko, that's coming out. It in May as well. Later in May, it's called To Run the World. And it's the history of the first Cold War, Cold War One. And Sergei was able to get access to recently declassified materials from the other side, from the Kremlin, and from China as well, and get a view into their thinking and insights of how that first Cold War unfolded. So mine is about Cold War Two. His is about Cold War One.
Great. Fantastic. Well, if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, please let other people know about it by writing about it on your social media page or ours. And if you want to subscribe to future episodes, that would be wonderful. And while you're on whatever platform you use to download this podcast, it'd be great if you could give us a positive review and a 5-star rating. We'll put links up to all the publications we mentioned on our website, ecfr.eu. But for now, from Dmitry Aparovich and myself, Mark Leonard, it's goodbye. The researcher for this podcast was Anand Sundar, and the editor of this episode is Mireya Farrow-Sarats.